Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to provide insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 266, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Inder Singhal. Dr. Singhal is in practice in Kentucky, and we discuss his career, as well as his work with international work, including his organization, which has provided international missions work in Belize. We discuss the impact of coronavirus 19 on international travel, as well as strategies that younger ophthalmologists can use to build a career where they have a role in international ophthalmology. As always, a list of financial disclosures are listed in the episode description. You can also find links in the episode description to claim CME credits at the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Inder Singhal. Dr. Singhal is the Chief Medical Officer at Bennett and Bloom Eye Centers in Kentucky, a multi-specialty group that serves patients with both anterior and posterior segment disease, and he is a vitreoretinal surgeon. And we're going to talk a little bit about his practice style, but also the international work that he does. Dr. Singhal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jay, for the opportunity.
So we always ask a new guest the same question. How did you get to this point, right? So why did you choose ophthalmology? And then why retina? And how did you end up in Kentucky?
I'm going to sort of take a step back and take a couple of minutes of your time and audience time to explain who I am, where I came from. I was born in India and raised in a small town in Punjab, North India. We belonged to a middle-class family and business family. By the time I was in grade 8, the things fell apart, business fell apart. Next few years were quite rough. So I started working to help my family at much early age. And I did a bunch of things for the next 4 years. Eventually ended up in United States in 89, worked all kinds of jobs. Believe it or not, I was a sandwich artist at Subway, worked most 7-Eleven stint and at Sutta Mattress. It was a great opportunity. I was able to work in the afternoon shift, and I went to UC Davis in the morning classes. And towards the end of my college, mom was diagnosed with cancer. Originally, the plan was to be a chem major, but when I saw what she was going through, I think that influenced me quite a bit, and I ended up going to medical school. And during medical school, I was exposed to different specialties, realized ophthalmology offers a great mix of clinical and surgical subspecialty, and I loved it, and ended up going to Kresge Eye for rotations. I still remember looking through teaching scope, Gary Abrams pointed to histolesion, and I think that was it. I knew my hobby. I spent some time with Dr. Abrams, Dr. Dean Elliott, and then end up at New York Eye Ear Infirmary, and imagine all those great retina docs there, Dr. Joe Walsh, Richard Rosen, Jintley Lipkani. They all influenced me and reinforced my desire to become a retina doc. And that's how I end up in retina.
Before we go into that, let's take a quick step back. I love the story, and it's interesting. We just finished reviewing ophthalmology residency applications this year, and it's hard to pick up in an application, and people value different things, but there's this concept of grit. You know, people have talked about that you don't necessarily have to face adversity to become great in your field or have great potential, but there's value in people who have overcome something because they've demonstrated that they do have that grit or this ability to overcome some sort of hardship or adversity. And one of the questions was, we have a couple of applicants who have done very well in medical school or college who worked at the same time out of necessity. And you talked about you had to work out of necessity during that time. I mean, how, when you kind of evaluate your own recruits to your practice or younger doctors, do you think that's valuable? You know, is it valuable to have somebody who does have some real working experience prior to entering medicine, whether it's in service industry level or higher?
So my view will be biased, but I strongly believe that. I think when I still remember my first paycheck in the United States was $114 for that week. And I still remember making $3.25 and working hard for it. I think there's a huge value when you see what people go through in life and what people live on a daily basis. So I think the value that is when I'm seeing patients who are coming to see me with chronic problems every 4 weeks, every 6 weeks for injection, and they are driving a 1974 pickup truck, but they have to pay me the certain pays. I think I'm probably a little bit more empathetic in that regard. As far as the work ethics are concerned, I think sometimes we feel if you have lived adversity, your work ethics are better. I'm not sure of that. I think our overall receptorship makes a huge difference. You know, when I train, Dr. Walsh will check my collars in the morning, 7 o'clock conference, all of us, and point to us, we need a haircut or, you know, wear clean collars. You know, you don't have to have 20 shirts. You can have 2 clean shirts. I mean, our receptors do make a huge difference in who we are. And he would constantly remind us as a resident, you don't have to worry about insurance. You don't have to worry about if patients can pay or not.
Uh-huh.
You do the best you can do for that patient. And that's all that matters. So I think your adversity does that, but I think your preceptors make a huge difference in who you are being trained.
That's a great point. I think, you know, residents certainly work really, really hard. I think many of us would want to quote unquote repeat residency for some of the things we're asked to do, but there's certain things that are very valuable from a patient care standpoint. New York Ioneer is similar to Bascom Palmer and other programs where there's a little more ownership of the patients and they're very busy. That is a benefit where you don't necessarily have to worry about the insurance or financial side, which is a huge part of what we do on a daily basis as attendings. So you go for your retina fellowship, and then at that point, do you move to Kentucky off the bat? What drew you to Kentucky,
yes,
and how was that adjustment?
Yeah, so my wife Seema, I think has a role that she played here. She wanted to move to a mid-sized town, which in her mind will be much better for our children as we grow our family. So we interviewed a lot of mid-sized towns, and Louisville, Kentucky, where I am right now, I visited this practice. It was just, I don't know, it was gut feeling that it felt like an honest practice. And the team was great, established team was great. And I could see myself here for the rest of my life. And here I am, we went from 5 when I joined to 18 doctors now. We went from 3 offices to 7 offices. We're going and I've enjoyed my time here. I'm blessed with just amazing team and amazing patients here, and never looked back.
Now, as part of your practice, and one of the things that we're going to talk about is you do your own separate international work through organizations that you've helped spearhead. One of the common questions we'll get from medical students that they transition through training. So I think a lot of medical students are drawn to ophthalmology because there is this strong element of global service and ability to do international work and restore sight to patients who may not otherwise have means to get that. For example, cataract camps that are done where surgeons will go and do surgery for weeks at a time. But one of the questions that comes is as they transition, for example, into a career in retina as residents, they say, well, how do I maintain this? And I think kind of the two challenges, and the first one we'll talk about is, how do you balance that when you're in an active clinical practice? Not only balancing it with taking care of patients who may need, you know, they can't have their doctor just like go out of town too often because they need kind of consistent care, for example, with intravitreal injections, but also in terms of the model of the practice and how it gets balanced with doctors who don't do that work. Is it something that comes out of vacation time? Is it something that comes out of something else? How do you kind of make those decisions and sacrifices?
Absolutely. So you are correct, Jay. It does affect your practice obligations that you have to your patients and your colleagues in the practice. Now, it took me, I would say, 2 or 3 years to set this model up. The first thing I did, just like everyone else, you know, I was very fascinated with providing cataract surgeries abroad, and I thought that's what I would do when I originally thought of doing this. But soon I realized there's even bigger unmet need, which is providing retina care. And when I say retina care, the diabetic retinopathy care. And I realized, my goodness, I can actually do even better if I start doing lasers for diabetic retinopathy patients. And that started about 6 years ago. I'll go over how the program set up there and then how I changed my practice model here to accommodate those needs. So let's take BCVI, which is Belize Council for Visually Impaired. That was started by the first prime minister's, ex-prime minister's wife, Joan Musa, in Belize in 88-89. With help of Lions Club and Rotary Club from England. And what they did, they set up these clinics that are covered by optometrists. So they were just providing basic care. And then a couple of ophthalmologists from the U.S. started going there on a regular basis to help with cataract surgery. There was just, you know, iffy retina service provided here and there. So 6 years ago, when I started going there, those patients were screened by optometrists, and that allowed me to just go there, provide that very focused service. And we started by, first I went there for a week at a time, but I was seeing a lot of patients who didn't need my service. But over the 2 year period, we were able to start creating a funneling system where optometrists will see the patients and use the fundus cameras, and I will be able to screen some of those patients even from here who need to see me for treatment. We do not provide anti-VEGF therapy there. We only do lasers, focal and PRPs, and sometimes I do bilateral focal, not sometimes, majority of the times, bilateral focals and bilateral PRPs in one setting. So what that did, that eliminated my time need in Belize. So I will take 6 o'clock flight in the morning on Thursday. Mm-hmm. I will work Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then back on Sunday. So I only lost 2 days of work. On this end, I was able to work with my colleagues who were willing to cover me because I wasn't away from the practice for too long. What I would strongly encourage people who are interested in doing this, if you are in a group practice where you have a colleague who is willing to help you, if you take 2 days, 2 work days, every 3 months, every 4 months, it's very doable. And you will be surprised what you can accomplish in 2 and 3 days of lasers or retina service that you can provide in a developing country. No matter where you live in states, you can easily take a flight and go to South and Central America in 4 to 5 hours. And if you leave early enough with time differential, you can do good work even the day you arrive there. I carried my laser with me in the beginning. Then we slowly have bought lasers there. So I go there and I arrive Thursday around 11. Thursday, I work in Belize City and I usually see about 60 to 80 patients. And then I travel each day when I'm there to a different place. So it's very easily doable once you streamline the process with help of your local team, wherever you will end up going.
Yeah, I mean, those are some great, great real-world experience-driven pearls. And I think that the point about the time and how to be efficient with it is a really important point. Like you said, you don't need to go for weeks, you know, to make a difference. And I think it's a lot of it, like you said, is the infrastructure and what's set up. I'm curious, you know, the other big challenge that exists here right now is coronavirus and COVID-19. What have you guys done as an organization? What have you done personally in terms of your international work? And what do you see going forward, you know, as we head into 2021? It doesn't seem like a vaccine is imminently on the horizon. How has that really affected these patients' ability to get care? Obviously, they want to be safe from coronavirus as well, but these eye issues affect their quality of life.
So it's very challenging. Both Belize and Guatemala, where I visit, are completely shut down. I have not visited any clinics in this year, and I'm not expected to go back till February, and who knows if that will work or not. And so one of the things that I learned during my last couple of years in Belize, you know, I used to enjoy going there. I felt great because there were lineups of patients to see me, and they were also thankful and they were also appreciative. But every time I was leaving, I just didn't feel right for the last couple of years. And each time it was, you know, that thought, well, what if, means, you know, I'm 55 years old and I'm at a stage in my life where, you know, I'm of Indian origin and I eat healthy, I live healthy, yet I cannot escape my genes. And I felt like I was doing disservice by treating those people and then leaving, not having infrastructure there. And this COVID definitely has brought that to the surface, how suddenly all the work that we have done in small areas, it is going to just now revert back to square one. So in 2018, my wife and I had set up a foundation. And what we're doing is we decided we're going to change the model of care and we're going to take ownership of small areas. So we will be focusing in Belize and we'll be focusing on North Guatemala and South Mexico, that whole triangle there where they all meet. Point is, what we're doing, we are offering scholarships to locals to go to optometry school and medical school, and in return, we will pay for their tuition, we'll pay for their room and board, and in return, they will stay in the community to serve the community for 4 years, and we'll pay them fair market rate. Now, one will argue, well, what if they leave? And they're not working for the organization that you're supporting. That's okay, because our goal is to train them in those countries. So it's not like if we train someone in Guatemala, that person will be able to go to US to practice. That person has to stay in that community. And even if they are private practitioners, they're still serving the need and not the community still has an ongoing being provided the care. Right now, take for example, Guatemala and Pachan. You have just two clinics. They're served by an organization called Visualiza, which is just a transitory satellite service once a month. And retina service is very iffy. Take, for example, Belize. There are two local ophthalmologists serving the whole country who are general ophthalmologists, and they do practice retina, but the service is not readily available. So if we are able to train people and then retain people and then convince them to provide service locally, I think that's the model that will eventually work. And that's where we're heading. So take COVID now. For 2020, there's no laser service provided to anyone in Belize, really. And we don't even know if they will open in 2020, spring of 2021, although I'm booked to go there, that we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. Imagine if our model that we're thinking of implementing, if that works. So we have some students now in medical school, but we're looking at 5 years from now, they will be able to provide those services on an ongoing basis. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's complicated. Like a lot of things that we're talking about, not only as physicians, but as people and as members of the world, you know, any sort of travel is very difficult to plan in advance. You know, one of our good friends is getting married abroad in May. And the question, it's very difficult to kind of make a decision whether or not that's even going to happen. We'll just have to see how things evolve over the next few months. Well, Dr. Singhal, this has, I think, been very illuminating. I think very helpful, especially this is maybe the most common thing, again, having just read all these residency applications, most common thing that many applicants talk about is they want to be involved in global ophthalmology. Any finally final pearls of advice for young doctors or doctors to be who aspire for a career in global ophthalmology? Any final pearls before we leave?
Yeah, definitely. So I think we should all read a report WHO published in 2019. It's about a 180-page long World Vision report. I think we should all start there because it really shows all the inequalities in eye care, vision care in the world. There are about 2.2 billion people in this world with vision impairment, and 800 million of those are easily fixable with just glasses. And so, yes, you know, providing cataract surgery or retina surgery is very rewarding, and it's sort of, you know, I'm going to use the word sexy because, you know, you take the patch off and the person is seeing it, it sounds great. But I think we tend to forget that even just a simple pair of glasses can make a life-altering impact on someone. And we should focus on low-hanging fruits. We should also, as if we are interested in these projects, take ownership of a small area. Just create networks in small countries in a small area and start going there and start visiting on a regular basis. And you will be surprised how you will become just part of that community and what an impact you will make. In the beginning, it's not going to be all that great because you are the one setting up the infrastructure in some ways. You are setting up those expectations. But soon enough, you will realize how important you will become. But once you take ownership, try to withdraw yourself from being the main attraction because your goal is to serve that community, not serve your own ego. So you have to withdraw yourself away and ask yourself serious questions. How can I really impact this community? How can I really impact this area? How can I provide ongoing service? How can I make a difference? Does that mean financial support, education? Does that mean training? Are you better off training someone there who's going to provide that service on a daily basis, or are you better off just doing it yourself? So ask yourself those serious questions, and you'll be surprised how quickly you will become a huge part of the World Vision Impairment Alleviation Program. As far as, you know, you're anyone who's interested in learning what I do and how can I help, I'm happy to connect people to my context and my network.
Perfect. You know, Dr. Singhal, thank you so much for waking up early on a weekend morning to talk to us and to give us some insights, real world insights into not only your journey, but sort of the things you've been able to do now as a busy retinal surgeon, but as someone who's done a lot of good internationally and abroad in Belize. I'm sure you passed through Miami on some of those flights. I don't know where exactly it connects, but there's a nice direct from Miami to Belize City. So if you ever happen to connect through, just reach out and maybe we can catch up.
Definitely, definitely. And if anyone wants to reach out to me, they can reach out to me at indersingle@yahoo.com. Or the website that we have is letshelptheworldsee.com, and I'll be happy to help.
Perfect. And we'll put a link to the website in the episode description. So if anyone's interested in learning more about this organization, Dr. Singhal's contact info he just referenced, and then also we'll have the website link. So Dr. Singhal, thanks so much, and look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you, Jay. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
As always, this episode and all prior episodes can be found on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 266 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. In addition, you can find links to subscribe and receive email updates on the latest episodes as they are released. We are on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can also subscribe on the Apple Podcasts or Android Podcast app on your mobile device. We love to be reached. If you want to reach us, our email is retinapodcast@gmail.com. You can also click the contact us link on our website. I love feedback. Any ideas for future episodes or things we can do better, please let me know. And we love the positive reviews you leave in the Apple and Android store. Many thanks to Dr. Inder Singhal for joining me. Thanks to Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Venacasa for providing the social media and production for this episode. Thank you, listeners, for listening, for keeping with us over the last 4+ years, for taking care of the patients you take care of every day, for publishing articles, and for inspiring conversations here on a weekly basis. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cut.